I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 149 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. This week, we go behind the scenes of an independent record label and record store out of Portland, Oregon, Jackpot Records, with its founder, Isaac Slusarenko. Slusarenko opened his Jackpot record store in 1997. Vinyl wasn't much in demand those days. He had trouble moving albums that are now collector's items. And when he began selling online, fax machines were involved. But he stuck to it, and in 2004, he launched the Jackpot record label. He was releasing records, not CDs. And he started with a vinyl edition of the 1971 self-titled psychedelic soul album by Beauregard, a Portland wrestler. Slusarenko explains how he chose and got the rights to that one. At that time, the Discogs marketplace hadn't even been launched, and record buyers weren't so obsessed with AAA mastering. But Slusarenko explains how sound quality was always baked into the plan. The Beauregard album was mastered by renowned mastering engineer Kevin Gray, a repeat Caro Pop guest, and Gray continues to master Jackpot's releases. Albums by the Portland punk rockers Wipers followed, and the label has grown to feature more high-profile releases, such as multiple albums by Booker T and the MGs, The Meters, Etta James, The Electric Prunes, Flamin' Groovies, and now the so-called father of Exotica, Martin Denny. Some albums, such as Mel Brown's Chicken Fat and Bill Evans and Jim Hall's Undercurrent, have been reissued recently on other labels as well. How does the licensing of these titles work? How does Slusarenko try to make sure that his Jackpot pressings stand out? How important is the cover art? How does he make deals with Newbery Comics to carry special pressings of Jackpot albums? Jackpot is a fixture on Record Store Day, and Slusarenko has released many albums in a psychedelic rock wheelhouse. Earlier this year, I took a flyer on the Jackpot pressing of the 1968 self-titled debut album by Gandolf, a psychedelic pop band in the mold of the Zombies. Very cool. How can we hang on to a dream? Other Record Store Day Jackpot releases have included the self-titled 1968 debut from the psychedelic fuzz guitar band SRC and drummer Hal Blaine's out there 1967 instrumental album, Psychedelic Percussion. If you're into records and music, and really, would you be here if you weren't? You're gonna love hearing Slusarenko break down the business of operating a brick-and-mortar record store, selling albums online, and preparing and releasing albums on his own label. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Isaac Slusarenko. Hi, Isaac. Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Mark. Hi.
So Jackpot Records, record store, record label. Store came first, right? 1997, you opened?
Yes. In October 97, I opened the store. I'm from Portland, and I had worked for another record store for 6 years, which at the time was very influential about learning about all types of music. It was the oldest record store in Portland, and it had the most variety of music of any store in town. And at the time, Portland had more record stores per capita than anywhere in the nation.
Nice.
And so while working there, I worked there for almost 6 years while I was in college. I became a buyer and I was a manager and learned the business, but also got exposed to music before the internet was around. So it was sort of like my chance to grow and learn while kind of seeing how a record store environment business works. And so in 97, I decided to leave that store and open Jackpot and took the risk to try to do it on my own.
Yeah. So 97, you know, the record store landscape was much different than it is now. It was much more about CDs at the time. Were you doing vinyl at the time too? And were you doing used records and new?
Yeah, I would say at that time it was about 50-50, 50% vinyl, 50% CDs was our kind of makeup of the store. But vinyl has always been a big component of the store. And the name of the store is Jackpot Records. So records to me always resemble vinyl to me.
I was going to say records was always in the name. So that's always a sign that you treasure that part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, at the time when CDs were still in competition with vinyl, I mean, there was customers who would only buy records, or there'd be customers who only buy CDs. There wasn't as much overlap, but I think at the time now, looking back, that we had the opportunity to, you know, both were being made at the same time. They both were making CDs and vinyl on the same release date, and that doesn't happen so much nowadays. It's right. Either these aren't getting made or they get pushed back.
Well, it's interesting too, because a lot of those vinyls from back in, you know, like the early 2000s, late 90s, have become like collector's items because there just weren't that many pressed at the time.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I remember, it's interesting, when I was working before I started Jackpot, I remember when Nirvana In Utero came out on vinyl and nobody bought it. Like, we couldn't sell it. Huh. And it was one of those things that most people were buying CDs or tapes. And they had to put them on sale just to get them out the door. And now that's a very collectible, rare record.
Right.
So it is funny that the format didn't really make it more exciting for people like it does nowadays. I think more people are excited to finally get the record they want on vinyl.
So what was your aim in opening your own record store? What did you, I mean, given that you're coming into this, you know, market where there are more record stores per capita than anywhere else, what was it that you wanted to do differently?
So when I started the store, my vision was to have a store that would be a neighborhood store. I opened in a kind of a neighborhood location. But what was happening was the internet was coming around, and the vision of a store that would carry all types of music that I wanted to carry, new and used, was kind of turning more into the opportunity to have an online presence and sell it through a website. So the store that I used to work for, right at the time I left, sold to somebody who was going to invest into it and become like a depot where they would buy all these record stores and become a conglomerate, where it would be a portal on campuses, on colleges, where you would go in and you would type the record you'd want, and then it would be sent from that location to you. And to me, I wanted to have like a physical store, a physical presence, and continue doing things in this town how I felt like I used to remember shopping when I was a kid. Right. So I felt like it was a chance to keep that vision and that feeling of that store, of what a record store should be in this town. And we didn't care. We don't carry t-shirts, band t-shirts, or, you know, we don't carry candles or anything like that. We're strictly music. And that was a big part of my vision. It was music only. Like, that to me was the important thing.
So did you have online sales from the start?
No. I mean, we didn't have a website when we opened. It was like, I think we started the website in 98. So we didn't really have that part of the store set up yet. It just was a pretty, it was in that kind of time period where people are still trying to figure out how to get websites built and how to get product right. up on the website.
And how to push it out. I mean, it's pre-social media. So, you know, you had to really get them to come to you.
Yeah. I mean, I used to send my orders via fax machines. I mean, that's how it was still working back then.
And at what point in your thinking were you always like, oh, this would be, it would be fun to do a record label and a store? Or were you really just about the store for the first several years? And then, you know, at some point you're like, you know what, let's try this too.
Yeah, that's a good question. When I started the store, I just wanted the store to take off. I had no idea of wanting to start a label. And then I opened a second location in Portland. And at that time I decided I wanted to start a record store. So in 2004, I put my time and energy into starting our first release. But that was just the right time to do it. It was in 2004 for me.
And what was it that sort of made you think, oh, I want to start releasing albums too?
For me, it was being in the environment of seeing records come in and wanting and seeing what customers were kind of asking for. There was a lot of records that weren't in print, and a lot of local records and private press and different genres of music that kind of hadn't been repressed. And in Portland, the first record that I wanted to do was Beauregard, which was a Portland wrestler, which and he was from 1971. And it was Greg Sage of the Wipers' first performance that he recorded on as a member. He played all the guitar parts on it at 16 years old. It was super well recorded. None of the lyrics have anything to do with wrestling. It's like a psychedelic soul record.
Right.
And and being in this town and knowing the history of it and having the experience of being able to work with Reg Sage to do it and with Beauregard, to me was like a stamp of, they're excited about it. I'm excited about it. And I think we will have an audience who will be excited about it.
So how did that work? Did you have to go to Beauregard and say, look, I want to license this record? Was there a label that you made a deal with?
No, I worked direct with Greg Sage, who worked with Beauregard, because those two were in connection. And Beauregard and Greg gave their permission for us to work out a contract. And so we worked through Greg. And Beauregard at the time, if I'm remembering this correctly, when we were putting it out, I mean, his history had kind of like, there was no deep history of what he had done, but he was kind of retired and fishing and had a different life. So I think it was an exciting thing for Greg Sage and myself to put this out there, because I know he had a passion for Portland wrestling and he was part of that whole scene. And for me, I was wanting to try something that was kind of odd and weird, but like, once you hear it, it's a solid record that kind of fits in with the vision of the store, not having always titles that you expect to come out, but right. When they're out, you're like, wow, that was really cool. The interesting thing too is that there was a music video for that made in 1971, and it shows what Portland was like in 1971. It was filmed here and it was one of the first music videos. It was kind of what they had used to show before the wrestling matches on TV. So it was the first kind of music video kind of vibe with sports and wrestling. So it was like the first theme music that was ever created by a musician, because he wrote all the music. So it was, you don't have to be a wrestler fan to understand it at all. That's kind of the great thing about it.
Was there any trick to finding the source material? I mean, there weren't like CDs of this lurking about. Did someone just have the master tape and say, here you go?
Greg has the sources for it. So he was able to provide it. He had it all.
Nice. Yeah. And just regular black vinyl. This is before, it wasn't a matter of like having all these color variations. It just wasn't available before that.
Yeah, it was black vinyl. We pressed it at RTI at the time. And Kevin Gray, who I know you know, and most probably your audience too, he was working at RTI and he actually cut that. So many of our records, he cut through RTI while he was there.
Oh, interesting.
So we've had a long history of all of our records with great sound quality, thanks to Kevin and also us too, making the best source we can get. But at the time, nobody was asking, is this from master tapes? Is this AAA recording? People, it just wasn't that world. It was just kind of a quiet thing that wasn't really discussed. And it was pre-Discogs. So there wasn't that knowledge of, there's how many of these are out there. It was kind of a quiet, maybe Discogs might have been around a little bit. I don't think so. And
I certainly didn't know about it back then.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not the guy who would know necessarily, but it's like 2006. So social media is getting a little more and, but still it's pretty early. And yeah, I didn't like Kevin Gray now is a household name. I mean, just one of the more, coveted, mastering engineers, and you've used him for a lot of projects and you put his name on the sticker and, it's like he and Bernie Grundman and Chris Bellman and Ryan Smith. I mean, these are like the rock stars of like mastering engineers. It's interesting that there's so much, that people follow this stuff and you as a small, relatively small player compared to like, Blue Note or, just a lot of these other labels, Acoustic Sounds, you're working with, the best guy. So.
Yeah. And I finally got to meet him in person. He was in town and he came by the store and told me how much he gave a lot of praise to what we were doing. And that really meant a lot, because sometimes you feel like you put these records out there and you don't know the reception from the people who cut it, if they liked it, or, it's once it's out there, you get the feedback from customers or from people who are, excited to have it. But to have him say he was really enjoys working with us really meant a lot to me.
So when you started the label, did you have the idea that was going to become the main business or a main business, or was it always, was it at first sort of like, oh, here's something cool we could do on the side while we run a record store?
Yeah. When I was starting the label, I was trying to manage two record stores at the same time. And it was just really hard for me to have the time to devote to one or the other, because I would have to, I'd have to split my time up. So I ended up closing down one of the locations so I could focus my time on running the label. And so I made that decision to kind of put my effort into the label full time and still be in the store and part of it. But that would be kind of my way to put my dedication to wanting to continue the label, because we had put out records, but I just didn't have the time to do as much as I wanted to do.
Right. You know, and someone like Beauregard, again, most people don't know that artist. What was the first release you did where you felt like, oh, I've broken through to the mainstream now. I got something that, you know, other labels would have, you know, they wish they had this, yeah, and I can sort of get a lot more people interested in what we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually tied to Beauregard was working with Greg Sage to get the Wipers released on vinyl. That was a really, for me, it was something I'd always wanted to do and a passion of mine, but he had never worked with anybody to have that reissued. And I think because of the connection of wanting to work together to do this oddball weird record from Portland that maybe 1,000 copies were originally made, to approaching him to discuss that as our first record versus asking to do the Wipers record without knowing me or my track record, made it so that it was a lot more of an opportunity to get the chance to talk to him and to do the Wipers record. And we've done many recordings with him since.
So in these early releases, like, how many copies are you pressing up?
Boy, when we started, every one was 1,000. Beauregard might have been 500 on the first one, but I think all the rest were 1,000, because just at that time, it just, you'd have to get 1,000 jackets made and you'd have to get all the parts. It just was the way to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
And then what was the reception like? Like, was it, were you immediately like, oh, this works? Or were there sort of points where you're like, I'm not sure about this?
No, I felt pretty confident once the record was announced and released, and that people knew the importance of the Wipers records. They were a band that I think a lot of people had heard of, but had not had the chance to find. I never, even being from this town, I only saw Wipers records twice in working in the music industry. Mm. They just never floated in. And people who bought them kept them, and they just weren't something that a lot of people had a chance to listen to on vinyl. And so once those got announced, distributors were excited because they had a chance, because they knew the music. A lot of people knew the music, but they just never had a chance to have it or a chance to distribute it. So I think that was the time where I think a lot of people kind of started paying attention to what we were doing, was when those came out.
What were sort of the unexpected challenges in running a label and putting out these records?
At that time, the biggest challenge was trying to, I mean, this was still early pre-social media. MySpace was around, but there wasn't an easy avenue to get exposure unless you did print ad. Or you did, or you were able to have somebody write about it. And so at that time, a lot of local stores, like my focus on the label has always been a kind of with a record store mindset. Like, what records would I like to have in the store that I've never had a chance to find or see? So with that approach, I distribute to the record stores the record. So I would be the one invoicing and shipping to them. So I kind of got a direct link on how things were going from the actual stores who were selling them.
And how much of your personal taste is reflected in the label, and what is that taste?
I'd say most of it is my taste. I mean, I would say that there's definitely been some influences who have given suggestions, but I would say majority of it has been things that I've always felt needed to be reissued. And it's like a really obscure record that they maybe made 100 copies of a private press record to me is just as important as a Howling Wolf record or a Jandek record or Green River. Like, it's, it's really hard for me to be like, we're a genre specific label, because that's not the focus on what I want to do for the label. It's just to put out records that have really interesting covers, which to me is a big part of reissues, is having records that are interesting to look at. Because there is a lot of records that come out all the time nowadays. There's a lot of reissues. So I think it's important to have cool looking covers, definitely, or something that I think helps with what we want to reissue.
I used to buy a lot of records, and then it was the CD era. And I always thought, there's just something about going into a record store, thumbing through the CDs, was just never as much fun. I just never enjoyed it. It's like, it was fine, but I just was doing it less. And then as I kind of started buying more vinyl again, it became more fun again. And I think part of it is, just seeing the record art, on vinyl is just different from, the little, jewel case with the chip in it and the little booklet where the, the art doesn't look that good anyway. It's just a different thing.
Yeah. I mean, I'm guilty of, not guilty, but when CDs came out, I thought it was a really interesting idea that you could actually have like a digital, almost like a master copy of what a recording was. I mean, that's how I always kind of viewed that, is like, this is what they're saying is the source material for Sgt. Pepper's or whatever record.
Right.
And so, at that time when CDs came out, there was usually only one pressing. It wasn't like remastered. It was just out. And the opportunity to get like, oh, I got Zen Arcade on CD, or I got some other thing that was finally on a digital format, it was kind of cool and exciting, because it was, it was like buying it for the first time. But I know exactly what you're talking about the small artwork and the experience of shopping for CDs compared to shopping for records are two totally different things to me. Like, they're not the same experience.
Well, and even flipping the record over, as opposed to, and sometimes it's nice to just have a 40-minute flow of music where you don't have to stop after, halfway through, but there's something about sort of flipping over that record that's really satisfying.
Yeah. Yeah. It's part of the ritual. I mean, I talk to a lot of people who will stream during the day, and at night they listen to records, because that's just what they like to do.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great beers include the classic Anti-Hero IPA and the premium lager Cold Time. Whether it's summer or fall, there's no better way to refresh yourself than with Cold Time. It's never pasteurized, and it's brewed low and slow in a method that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans.
It's all a dream. How can we hang on to a dream?
What does the landscape look like for you now? Because there's so many players, trying to get these licenses and release these albums. Is it harder to do what you're doing now, or are you able to kind of stick with your niche? Like, on one hand, like on Record Store Day, I took a total flyer on this band Gandalf, because I think that you and I have like a bunch of overlap in our musical taste, because I'm definitely like into the 60s pop and soul thing. So when you did, the Meters, I'm like, and again, AAA, Analog, Kevin Gray, I'm like, boom, I'm on the Meters. Booker T and the MGs, boom, I'm on those. I just had Steve Cropper on Caropop, and I had Leo Nascentelli of the Meters on as well. I mean, it's like, but then also stuff that sounds like the Zombies, Gandalf, cool. So I'm guessing that when you're trying to get a Gandalf record, maybe you're not competing against a lot of other labels, but when you're doing Booker T and the MGs, Kraft has had some of that stuff, and so what is it like trying to get those things that are a little bit more popular?
Yeah, I just would like to say, the Gandalf record, the ironic thing about that record is that I was working on New Year's Day in the store, and I was the only employee at the time. This is probably, I don't know, 8-9 years ago. And Peter Sando of Gandalf came in the store, and I had just listened to the record the night before. And I've never met him. He was brought in from a friend and said, "Oh, hey, this is Peter from Gandalf." And I freaked out. I said, "Oh man, I am such a huge fan. I love that record." And we talked about the fact that there hadn't been a reissue that had been done on vinyl, like legitimately at that time. And so it took many, many years for it to finally happen. And so we reconnected. He wrote the liner notes and was part of the experience of putting it out for Record Store Day. So that was one of those situations where I was able to get, you know, the artist involved with the recording and the licensing. But it just takes time. And I think that's the hardest thing nowadays, is that projects that I'm working on take years to finally come out. And, you know, so I feel like that's kind of what the biggest struggle right now is, kind of being able to get these in production in a timely enough manner. So by the time I put it out, it's still exciting to me in the audience, because there is a delay from when the project starts to when it comes out.
Right. Well, yeah. And I'm curious about how far, you know, how much lead time you need for this stuff, but like Sun Ra, yeah. Space is the Place. Yeah. You guys did in what, like 2020, I think I had this right. Yeah. You did in 2020.
Yeah.
Verve by Request, Third Man had a version out 23, and then Vinyl Me Please had their spiritual jazz series and was part of that also in 23. Had you kind of already run your course with that one, or is that kind of annoying that, you know, you sort of have that record and then all of a sudden hear two other versions of it?
Yeah. I mean, we were early on putting that out. Like that was the title that I, that at the time wasn't viewed as a important enough record that for a major label to want to put back out in print. So, I wanted to make sure that we could get a chance to do that, but then eventually, you know, like most things, licensing expires and, you know, there's other visions that the majors would have with the title. And, you know, jazz in the last, I don't know, 10 years, not even 10 years, but there's been a bigger interest in jazz from the major labels recently, with more and more reissues coming out. So I think they're finally understanding the importance of their catalog of titles that in the past they would not have any interest in, but now they're viewing as like, oh, that's something that we want to have out. So that's where I feel like the major labels are right now.
If you don't mind, walk us through, like, what is a license like this? How does that work? You know, what are is like a period of time? It's a number of copies you can press. Is it like an option to repress? Like, how does it all, like, what's the deal that you're making to be able to do this?
It's all really different. I feel like most of the time it's an agreement for a certain amount of titles pressed with a certain time period that you have to do it in. And those royalties are part of the process of starting the agreement. So those are typically paid in advance. And then it's a question of whether or not there's going to be master tapes, whether or not what the source is going to be. And then when the time comes for the record to come out, you know, you're already probably halfway through your contract agreement because you've been waiting for all these parts to show up.
Right.
So it's typically, I mean, that seems to be the normal run of the course. If I'm working directly with an artist like Seish, for instance, you know, that was a record that they had only made 100 copies of. And I had every band member involved with getting that to license to come out. And that's just a different experience. And that's a lot more based on what, you know, the band wants to have happen in the packaging. So there's just a lot of different factors. One of the records we did was the Andromeda Strain with the hexagon shaped kind of like a camera lens, a foil that folds open. And then the record is actually hexagon shaped.
The record itself is.
Yes. The original record was hexagon shaped. And it was put in a foil cover that folded like a camera lens. So once you opened it, it was kind of really hard to put it back together. And that's how it originally was packaged. And for me to try to find a company who could press a hexagon shaped record that isn't a picture disc, but actually fit that into the exact packaging of the original was a real challenge. And we, you know, that was one of the titles we won an award on the packaging. But the, you know, even the original version of that came with a warning label that if you had an automatic, if you had an automatic return needle pickup, that it would damage your record, because the way, if you started a record, you had to manually put it on, otherwise it would get cut by the sharp edges of a hexagon.
Oh man.
So we even replicated the danger sticker so that people would be aware of it. But that was a really, like, that was a fun project. That was a major label title that, you know, that packaging on that was really crazy to do. But, you know, that was just part of the one title that I had wanted to do exactly that way.
And then something like Booker T and the MGs, is that's a more limited license, I would imagine.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
So like, what is that? So how does that work? Is it, do you get like 2 years, 3 years, 1 year, a certain number of copies?
And then... It's typically 3 years. And then with the title, once it's out, then it's sort of like, if we want to repress it, we reach out, we get another pressing made through the manufacturer. So different, like that's a different situation where that's handled by Warner and how they operate differently. So they are the ones who actually... they kind of like, they're more hands on in the process. Like they will actually get the record shipped to me. It's sort of that there's a different kind of path on how those work. But typically when we do it, it's about, you know, it's however many we need to press up front, but then we have a time period that starts on how many we can do after that. And usually the represses are like at 1,000 at a time.
Yeah. And the Electric Prunes you did recently also. And I think that was a Warner's, was that like Reprise or one of those labels too. So are you making the deal with Warner's for that then? Like sub-licensing it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's Rhino and Warner's. Yeah.
But in that case, again, you're getting the original master tape. You're getting Kevin Gray to do it. Is that expensive to, you know, go with the all analog and get the, you know, get the guy?
Yeah, it is expensive. I mean, I won't say that's not, but it's so worth it. And for me, I've always tried to keep the price point down on the AAA masters, because it's, you know, as a store, I like a lot of records are $30 to $40 now. And I try to keep ours between like $28 and $30 for the AAA mastering. And I feel like, you know, people appreciate like the Electric Prunes, for instance. You know, that's a really a title that I feel, you know, is good to have the source if it's available. So whenever I can get an analog tape, I try to do it if it's possible. It's just really up to whether it exists or not, or if it's available for being able to be transferred.
It seems like you guys are pretty reasonable in keeping these under $30, because a lot of them, you know, have gone way over $30, and you got the AAA, you know, Kevin Gray pressing of the stuff, and you know, the unique numbered vinyl, colored vinyl, and all that. So that seems like you're keeping it in sort of the reasonable range. Does that just feel like that's where it should be in terms of what your cost is, or are your margins like really tight when you're doing that?
The margins are tight, but again, I think if my like our I don't visualize the release only going through direct to consumers. Like, I don't think that's not the path. When I do these records, I go, we're going to just put these online. They're only going to be for this audience. Like I understand the importance of wholesaling to record stores and being on the other side of that, just seeing what we get in the store and what we're paying for things is kind of sometimes a sticker shock for us. Then having to put it out on the floor at an expensive price always feels, I don't know, it just feels odd to be like, oh yeah, it's a $50 reissue of a classic record. It's, you know, I feel it's, I'd rather have more people have the opportunity to find the record and feel like it is worth the price and it justifies it, than being upset and feeling like, oh, I better get my $50 worth out of this record.
Right. I discovered some of your records, you know, being in Chicago, I haven't been to Portland, which I would love to do. And I discovered some of them through Newberry Comics. Cause I used to live in Boston way back when, and I'd go on their website and they'd have all these, you know, colored vinyl things. And some of them I would realize were jackpot records, like, Flaming Groovies. So I think I bought that version of Shake Some Action. And then later I sort of went to your website. I'm like, oh, I could have just gotten it directly from you. How does that work where you're, you know, Newberry Comics will have their own color variations for the meters or Flaming Groovies or whoever?
Yeah. They usually would reach out to me, or depending on the title, I would reach out to them to see if they are interested in a exclusive version for them. Then we would agree on like what kind of color they want to do or what kind of variation they would like to have. We did a similar thing with Vinyl Me Please a long time ago with a couple of our titles. We made releases for them. But yeah, it really kind of depends on the title of whether or not they're interested in wanting to have a variant, because I don't want there to be a million different versions of it out there. I just want to have it so that it's fair to all the people who want one. And Newberry Comics has been great. I mean, they're, you know, a record store chain, and I liked working with them. They were great. So it was nice to be able to go like, oh, great. It's going through record stores. It's going through, you know, somebody who's in the business.
Well, Newberry Comics is another one where, you know, if you live in Boston, you can go in those record stores. But if you don't live in Boston, they have a pretty robust online business, and you can sort of scroll through a lot of stuff and go, oh, look, there's that. So,
yeah, I visited once many, many years ago, and I'm surprised at how many stores there were for that region. Like, there was a lot of, it seemed to be, Newberry Comics locations. So it's kind of a regional thing. I think if you know about it in that area, it's sort of your back pocket record store.
Right. What were the ones you did for Vinyl Me Please?
We did, the Ennio Morricone Exorcist 2. Soundtrack, and we did the Dune soundtrack. I think those are the two that come off the top of my
head. I remember seeing those. And in terms of like the vinyl, like the color, like you guys have a lot of cool splatter, and you know, or it'll be like, you know, the sky blue is like the first 500, but then you can get the red if you get the next, and then these are numbered and these are not numbered, or these are limited and not limited. Like, what are the things that sort of move the needle aside from the music itself?
Yeah. It depends on the project. Like, local band Poison Idea, a punk band, they're working with Jerry of the band. We decided to do, well, let's just do a silkscreen edition of the record. Like, it was talking to the artists, like, what can we make that's cool? Oh, let's do a signed version. Like, we did, got the artist who did the original West Coast Pop Art Volume 3 record artwork. The artist who did that got him to sign records to do an edition of 50. Or we had, we had Ken Babbs, who was involved with Ken Kesey, to sign 50 copies of the Acid Test. So it kind of is just sort of like, well, what it would be kind of a fun, cool thing to put out that is something unique and different than just colored vinyl. And then colored vinyl on its own, I mean, it's sort of dependent on what the packaging would look like and trying to make it fit with the colors and a design. And a lot of times too, like, colors go out of print. Like, we've had production issues where we were planning on a packaging with a certain color. It's all ready to go, and at the last minute, they're like, sorry, they don't make that color anymore. Huh. So we have to kind of shift gears immediately and kind of solve how to get something corrected without losing the intention of what the vision of that release was.
Do you feel like your audience really values those color variations as opposed to if you just put everything out on black vinyl?
There's almost like two different camps that are always, you know, if you do black vinyl, people ask, when are you going to do colored? And if you do colored, like, why don't you do black? So it's sort of like, we try to do both as much as we can, if we can do two different versions of a black and a color. But typically, you know, I like to do usually first pressings of things on a colored vinyl. And you know, with knowing that we're getting good materials and good sources for the colored vinyl, because I know a lot of there's been a lot of discussion of, you know, colored vinyl doesn't sound as good as black, but you know, that sort of depends on who's pressing it, the plating. There's a lot of factors in what makes the record sound good, not just the color.
Yeah, I might get disqualified from having any credibility by saying this, but I mean, I have a lot of really good sounding splatter vinyl records, you know, and I mean, and I understand that, you know, the black is the best, you know, supposedly, but, you know, or clear is good too, but I don't know. It seems like gold is maybe the most problematic for some reason. But other than that, and don't get a picture disc. Like, picture discs don't sound as good. That's the common knowledge. At least I don't play any picture discs, so I don't know. But but I have plenty of really great sound. I mean, those Meters records you did, I mean, those sound fantastic, and those are splatter vinyl as well.
Yeah, yeah. Don't do Glow in the Dark. That's the one.
Glow in the Dark, I've heard too, right? I don't get any glow in the dark for that reason. I've heard those are bad. What is the split now in your business in terms of like the record store versus the label? Like, which do you spend more time on, and which is the sort of more important, you know, part of the business at this point?
I would say I spend about 85% of my time on the label. I still distro all the records myself, so I'm the one shipping them out to stores and to distributors. So I have a hands-on approach to our stock, what we have, where it's going. And that's a big part of what I've always been in, that part of the process. So it doesn't go to one distributor who just, I don't know what they're doing with it. I don't know how they're packaging or sending it. Like, I am involved with that part. So that is, besides that and taking on new projects and working on current projects, I'd say that's about 85% of the time. And then the rest of the time it's helping with the store. But yeah, it's been a nice, it's nice being in the environment of the record store as well. Like, seeing what's coming in, being involved with, I don't do the ordering for the store as much anymore for the product that comes in. My manager has been here over 10 years and we still discuss what to bring in, but I have complete faith that what they're bringing in, I don't have to do that side of it. And I can do this other side of the business in the way that I want to keep doing it.
Are you the one who sends out the emails on, you know, oh, we have this new album in, or this, that, or the other thing? Or do you have like a staff to do some of that?
Typically it's myself, but I finally have some help this year. So this is the first year that I brought somebody on to help with that.
On the record store side, like, what's the split of business of, like, you know, online mail order versus, you know, people coming in?
Oh, store or
like physical visitors versus you putting it in a box?
I'd say it's about 50-50, to be honest. I mean, we do get a lot of visitors in Portland and at our store. So we do have a lot of titles here that get picked up here. But for like a lot of initial releases, we might get mail order for people in other countries or other places. So I would say, you know, maybe 50-50 would probably be a pretty good way of thinking of that part. And then as far as like when we get those, when we get the titles back in print, it's usually the first new release schedule of what we send out is when we get most of the mail order, because those are new titles that are out and people are excited to get them before they go out of print. One of the things too that I've been part of for many, many years is producing records for Record Store Day. And that to me has been a really important part of the label. We've done a lot of releases for Record Store Day. And I feel like we're one of the fewer smaller labels who are participating. Like, we're a record store. We're not a major label. So for me to put titles in and be with the same group as, you know, Kiss or whoever else might have their release coming out, and yet we're having as much interest, like we have people super excited for our records coming out, it's important that I think Record Store Day as a event day is something that I specifically release titles for that day. So I'll do like Hal Blaine's Psychedelic Percussion, like that title specifically was for Record Store Day. And the SRC record we put out, that was for Record Store Day.
Right. And Gandalf originally.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I know there's a Record Store Day. There's many different ways to be viewed at it. But when I first started with them, there was a lot more independent labels kind of trying it out, dipping their toes to see what that world is like. And I feel like I've kind of almost yearly kept putting releases out to them. Cause I come from the mindset of the importance of record stores and wanting them to have things that they can have to keep their doors open. That's just an important thing.
Right. And Black Friday is coming up. And then you got April next year for the next regular Record Store Day. Do you know what you're doing for both of those?
I'm waiting for a couple things to answer about next year's record story. I have a couple things in line. I just have to finish it. But yes, we have some things that we're working on. Black Friday, to me, it's too hard of a time period for me to get things turned around in time because we're putting out things throughout the year. So Black Friday, to me, that to me isn't as an easy of a date for me to hit as it is for Record Store Day.
How far out do you have your releases scheduled?
From when I start the project to when it comes out, it might be a year and year and a half, but it really, this is a better way of saying it. I don't really set release dates until I know that the records are finished, because there can be hiccups at any time where something doesn't get made or something, you know, they're not able to get it done in time. So instead of saying, hey, we're going to have it on January 1st, but then to be like, sorry, we're going to have to push it back till March. I don't like to do that. I usually wait until I know they're getting pressed and finished, then I'll set the release date.
Do you know like your 2025 releases in general, or is it still kind of like some yes, some we're still figuring out?
Yeah, most of them. I mean, most of them are just in like final project review parts of, you know, artwork approval. And, you know, there's a lot of things that have to get checked off in time period that is not on my schedule, but somebody else's. But we have, I think we've got like 6 or 7 projects for next year that are all cooking in the background. They're all almost ready to come out. It's just getting to those last steps to finish.
Right. Yeah. What are the things that are especially tricky now? I mean, is there still sort of a backlog on the pressing plants or?
I'd say not so much the print. I would say most of the time it has to do not the scheduling of the pressing plant, because that's been a lot more relief. That's been getting way easier to get things done on a turnaround time. I still think that the biggest hiccup is getting all the parts laid out, approved, proofed, and the audio. Making sure the audio is correct, that there's no problems with test pressings. I mean, that still will randomly happen where for some odd reason, there's an anomaly that just happened when they were doing the plating process. And that has to stop the project, go back over and start it over again. So it's sort of like each time you start a project, I can't predict the exact date it's going to come out until all the parts are kind of checked off.
And is running the label, has that gotten... Would you say right now, is it sort of easier than it was, or is it harder because there's just more people doing this now?
As far as putting releasing records, you mean?
And just getting out. I mean, like on one hand, you guys know what you're doing. You've been doing this for a while. On the other hand, you know, if you're putting out like, you know, a Bill Evans record or something, you know that there are other people who are doing that as well. Mm-hmm. So you have to sort of, you know, carve out your territory maybe a little more carefully. I don't know.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I don't really think of that so much. I'm just excited about the titles that we're doing. So if I get a chance, you know, if we're doing Bill Evans, I'm stoked that we get a chance to have our version out there. And I do get to see, you know, all the titles that are coming in the door. But I feel like the vision, you know, sort of the chance to be able to get these out the door to on our label makes it... that I'm not really too concerned about other records coming out. Cause for me in the store, it seems like there's a lot more new releases every week coming out, more than there was a couple years ago. It seems like it's really hard to keep track of all the new releases that are out each week. So I feel like that's kind of the hardest that's the hardest thing to solve, is how do you stand out from all the other titles that are coming out week after week? And so, I mean, I just think that we do what we've been doing, and we've been lucky to make sure that when we put it out, that we announce it and then we have some kind of, press behind it. But I feel like, you know, there's always going to be more and more titles coming out, and especially with major labels putting out titles from their catalog, you know, it's people only have so much to spend. And so you have to do something good and unique.
Right. So on one hand, you have more competition with the stuff you're releasing. On the other hand, you have more inventory for your store.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And something like, you know, Bill Evans and Jim Hall, you guys did Underwater, which is a really nice pressing of that. And I think Mo-Fi has a version of that, and there's some other ones. Do you look at that like we want to do the definitive version of this record, or is it like we just want to do our version that we think is going to be really cool?
I, you know, like... The MoFi, I usually try to make it as close to the original as possible. So when we did that, the packaging on that is the same like craft paper that it was printed on. Like I wanted it to be as close to the original. It wasn't like a coated slick cover. It was an actual version that the original felt like. Nice. So I feel like when I put it out there, I'm very visual. Like I'm much more visual in how I approach things. And I like things to look how I remember seeing them or they originally were released. And that's where I feel like I don't have to worry about other pressings of it because I know the version that we're doing hasn't been done as close to the original, or that's the intent behind why I want to do it, is to make it like that.
Well, and again, it's a title that if you go into a record store, you're going to maybe see that title, but yours is reasonably priced, AAA, and looks good.
Yeah. And cover artwork to me is really, I feel like that cover is an example. That's just a cover you don't forget once you see it. And I feel like I try to get those titles that invoke that kind of thing where you were like, oh, a Martin Denny record. I remember a Martin Denny record because they look a certain way. And so I think that's a very big point of the titles that I release too, is that they do have some sort of visual impact that stand beyond the music. Because even if you don't listen to it every day, you might remember that package, like the Gandalf cover. Like, you know, it's easy to recall. There's nothing that really looks like it. You know, I think that's an important thing on the titles that I choose too.
Is it a big factor, like whether you use like a tip-on jacket or I forget all the different terminologies of different, types of covers?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny is that when COVID hit, that time period, we had a lot of titles in production, and those pressing plants were like Stoughton weren't giving any kind of turnaround time for things to get done. And it wasn't until a couple years later that they said, okay, you know, things are kind of back to normal. So we had to kind of pivot and figure out a way, how can we do it to not always have to count on certain plants to produce a certain kind of jacket. And we've used Stoughton for many different packagings, but you know, it depends on their turnaround time. So if they're not able to have a title that we need to kind of get done, you know, we'll get the closest thing or the next best thing to that if possible. And, you know, there's lots of things that can go wrong too with tip-on sleeves. Like we've had pressings that, you know, there's new people at the plant, the color correction isn't right. Like there's been a lot of time, there's been situations where I'm like, okay, there's too many variables on this not turning out how it should. I have to choose a different place to go get these made now.
Well, I would imagine there'd also be a cost, effect to, the tip-on or the, paper sleeve versus the, plastic sleeve or whatever else. Like I would imagine that would all sort of enter into your calculation of how much you have to charge for it as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's every little part of it adds up, sticker cost, packaging, the inner sleeve, gatefold, it is part of the cost on it. But if an original record had a certain kind of design, like the Andromeda strain, like I want it to be like that as close as possible and still be affordable.
Anything else that I should have asked that I didn't? Anything else you want to tell us about your adventures in the record store and label world?
Yeah, I mean, I still enjoy doing what I do. And I feel like it's coming up with new titles is sort of always a challenge because I want to put out things that I feel are relevant that people will want. But I feel like this is a really good time for the label and the titles that we're putting out. So I'm really excited to see what, the response to these titles are.
Do you have a white whale that you've been seeking?
Not so easy off the top of my head. I mean, I think most of the ones I'm working on behind the scenes right now that are coming out next year are kind of some of those titles. So, yeah.
All right. So you'll keep us posted.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. It was great talking to you.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate it.
That's all for episode 149 of Karopop. Thanks so much to Isaac Slesarenko for releasing awesome pressings of cool albums on his Jackpot Records label and for making them and other albums available through his online and Portland, Oregon stores. Go to jackpotrecords.com and browse the fabulous website. You can still get Gandalf and the first 3 Meters albums four Booker T and the MGs albums, and even the West Coast Pop Art Experimental Band, among others. And if you find yourself in Portland, Oregon, get yourself over to the store at 3574 Southeast Hawthorne Boulevard. Jackpot also has a Facebook page and is on Instagram and Twitter at Jackpot Records. Boy, I hit the jackpot when I got Chris Swake to produce this and every other Caropop episode. For a mere $24, you could become a Caropop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at caropop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at CaroPopCast. And you can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caropop conversation. Thanks.